Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinton.
Well, Margaret, 2.5 million and counting, the number of Americans who signed up for coverage by mid-December on the federal marketplaces.
It should be noted that about half of those who've signed up during the second enrollment are returning customers, and many of them shopped around for plans that might better suit their budgets and their family needs. But the important thing is it does show that there's a very robust interaction beginning to happen with the online portals this time around, and everything seems much smoother.
There are still some issues. The volume is quite high in the federal exchanges, which is handling the insurance needs of about 37 states. So people seeking help from insurance navigators on the phone are being asked to leave their names and numbers, and they must wait for counselors to call them back with such high volume. Those callbacks are taking a few weeks to get back in some cases.
So about 500,000 people phoned into healthcare.gov to try and make the December 15th deadline for coverage to begin on January 1st. Kevin Cunahan, who heads up the exchange, says that everyone who calls by midnight on December 15th will see their coverage begin January 1st, even if the counselors couldn't get back to them right away. So I say he's doing a terrific job at the helm of healthcare.gov, Mark.
These new insurance marketplaces are also bringing differently structured health plans. The growing trend in high deductible plans requires some analysis for families who must calculate a slew of out-of-pocket expenses. It really is important to shop around.
And we've been watching another approach to the problem of covering the uninsured in America and also of controlling costs. Vermont was on track to become the first state to launch a single-payer system by 2017.
You know, Governor Pete Shumlin had campaigned on the promise of state-sponsored health plans for all Vermont residents. And Governor Shumlin made the recent announcement that after crunching the numbers every which way, there simply was no way to pay for the significant increases that would be in taxes.
Well, he did admit that the significant cost increases for employers and individuals would have negatively impacted the state's economy. And proponents of single-payer approaches were so disappointed because Vermont presented the best hope, maybe the only hope right now in the United States, for success. The state legislature had indicated that it was supportive of the governor's initiative, but that payment piece simply proved too challenging.
It's a movement that has not yet gained real steam, both politically and in the public arena, Margaret. But the idea is simply going to take some time to take root, which is unlikely in the current political climate.
Well, our guest today is someone who has a pretty global view of the current political climate and healthcare in this country and the importance of looking at health reform from a nonpartisan angle. Alan Weil is the editor-in-chief of the peer-reviewed publication Health Affairs.
Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks at false claims spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And if you have comments, don't forget to email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, or Google+. We love hearing from you. Now, we'll get to our interview with Alan Weil in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. And the numbers keep rising. Numbers of Americans who have signed up for health coverage on the federal and state exchanges has risen dramatically in the last couple of weeks of December. According to the Department of Health and Human Services, 6.4 million Americans were able to sign up for coverage on both the federal and state exchanges, up from 2.5 million just a couple of weeks ago. HHS Secretary Sylvia Matthews-Burwell is hoping for 9.1 million enrollees by the end of 2015. And this pace seems to be on target to reach that goal. But what about the cost? A survey of Americans shows more are grappling with health care costs than they were a year ago, a combination of paying for insurance where they might not have before, higher insurance rates due to some of the mandated coverage items under the Affordable Care Act, and largely the increased out-of-pocket expenses from plans with much higher deductibles. Meantime, the date's been set. The nation's high court will hear arguments on the tax subsidies for those buying insurance on the federal health exchange. The case will determine the fate of the tax credits to millions of consumers who've obtained insurance coverage through healthcare.gov. The case is based on language taken literally from the original bill. The FDA is lifting a decades-long ban on homosexual men donating blood. It was put in place in the earlier days of the AIDS epidemic. It is, however, continuing a ban on blood donations if a gay person has had sex with another person in the past year. 50,000 new AIDS cases cases per year are still happening in this country, and the numbers are highest among young gay men of color, many of whom don't know they're infected at that early age. Meanwhile, when do you think is the best time to enter the ER if you've got a critical cardiac event? If you answered when all the top cardiologists are away at a medical convention, you'd be right. A recent Harvard study looked at outcomes from patients who entered the ER with cardiac arrest or an incident related to congestive heart failure. When the top docs were all away, patients did about 10% better, with a 70% survival rate after 30 days, rather than a 60% survival rate when the top docs were in town. The study finds that fill-in docs are less likely to do invasive interventions that could yield more deadly side effects. I'm Ariane O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Alan Wild, editor-in-chief of Health Affairs, a leading peer-reviewed journal on health, healthcare, and policy. Before that, Mr. Wild was executive director of the National Academy for State Health Policy, NASHP, a nonpartisan organization helping states achieve excellence in health policy and practice. Mr. Wild, an attorney, was director of the New Federalism Project at the Urban Institute, a frequent speaker and author on health reform policy. Mr. Wild co-authored several books, including Federalism and Health Policy, and served on President Clinton's Consumer Commission on the Quality in Healthcare Industry, co-authoring the Patient Bill of Rights. He earned his master's in public policy and his law degree from Harvard. Alan, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
It's nice to be back.
Yeah,
thank you.
And it's been since 2011 when we discussed the Affordable Care Act, and lots has happened since then. We've gotten through the open enrollment period. 8 million Americans enrolled on and received coverage on the exchange, and 5 million accessed coverage through Medicaid expansion. If you break it down by states, it's been a patchwork quilt. Only about half of the states choosing to expand Medicaid, and we're seeing many Americans still left out on the promise of health coverage. What's your assessment of the outcomes from state to state, and is that what you envisioned would happen?
I don't think anyone anticipated the country splitting quite the way it has, and two elements were certainly not foreseeable by me. The first, I think I have a lot of company on, which is the Supreme Court, after all, is responsible for having made the Medicaid expansion something that states could choose to participate in or not. As the law was written, all states were to expand Medicaid, and we were going to have a uniform national platform of coverage. Now, with the court's rewriting of the statute, they said the federal government cannot tell states that if they fail to expand Medicaid, they'll lose their base funding for the program, and we have what you just described. I truly don't know a single person who thought that was where we were going to be at this point. We knew there was disagreement, obviously, over the Affordable Care Act when it was enacted, but what I didn't foresee was how much states would become a place where, even after the law was enacted and signed, that there would be such a division about whether or not implementing the law was something states were willing to participate in at all. And so you have significant element within the Republican Party that basically said anything you do that is involved in implementation of the law is anathema, that actually you should not take any steps to implement. And that is a big factor, I think, in the division today, and certainly not one that I expected.
Well, certainly, Alan, during these exciting and tumultuous years of health reform since the Affordable Care Act was being written and then passed, many of us looked to the journal Health Affairs as our source of information and analysis as developments were unrolling. You obviously are a longtime health policy advocate and expert. You've contributed frequently to Health Affairs, and now you're the editor-in-chief of what we think of as the peer-reviewed journal for health policy. Now, the journal began back in 1981, and I understand it now receives over 120 million unique visits per year at the website. So for our listeners, maybe tell us a little more about the journal's history, who the major participants and contributors are, and if there's any new directions that you're planning for the publication.
You go back to our first issue almost 35 years ago, and we had authors like David Stockman, who was the director of the Office of Management and Budget. We had Dave Durenberger, who was a United States senator from Minnesota. Cap Weinberger had been the secretary of what was then HEW, Health, right. Education, and Welfare, now HHS. So we started with the luminaries in the field, and I would say we still have them. We call upon a broad cross-section of health services researchers, physicians and economists and sociologists and statisticians. We cover the range of issues in healthcare as they relate to the policy environment in which we operate. And of course, it's a very busy, exciting place to be right now. As for new directions, mostly I'll say I take the helm of this terrific journal that is so strong I don't need to lay out a big plan of transformation. But I do think we're in an era of faster information where the traditional peer-reviewed journal is coming under fire, both from the time that it takes and the resources it takes, as well as the many distribution channels that are available to those who don't want to subject their work to peer review and want to get a message out much more quickly. And I think navigating that changing environment really is my top priority.
Yeah, well, let me pull the thread a little on that as you take on the mantle as editor-in-chief and saw an article, I think it's in this issue of how do health researchers use social media. So in this ever-changing world of how readers consume news, sort of where that audience is, not so much on the content side, but on the delivery side, thoughts about that. Even in the staid position that health fares is, you have others who are quite anxious about the transformation and what it might necessitate for organizations like yourself.
Well, we occupy a unique space, and one thing I think we all have to remember is there is not one typical reader. Particularly for the policy work we do, we are reaching CEOs of organizations. We're reaching young staff members on Capitol Hill. Mm-hmm. We're reaching practicing clinicians around the country and indeed around the world who are trying to understand the changes that are occurring. And I think we all know with the pace of change in how information is distributed and disseminated, those different audiences are looking to different sources. So for us, the issue is not we're at place A, we need to go to place B. It's making sure that as we think about our audiences, we have appropriate distribution channels for the range of mechanisms that they're accustomed to. Our core asset is credibility, and nonpartisanship is a very important part of that. Our peer review process, and as long as we build from that core, some people will learn of a new article in our issue because it comes in the mail. Some people will be Googling a topic and they'll find it. Some people will read a blog entry. Some people will read a tweet. At the end of the day, they're all going to the same content, and as long as we retain the quality of our content, I think we can reach people the way they're used to gaining access to information.
Let me take a quick look back, if I can, Alan. And you were in the health policy trenches back in 1990 when the Clinton administration took its shot at passing comprehensive health reform. And you've noted that the conventional thinking back then was that the three pillars of reform, improving access, improving quality, and containing costs, were actually competing interests and couldn't be simultaneously achieved. But you've more recently said that the Affordable Care Act has shifted that landscape on these three goals, and perhaps the ACA has made it possible to envision the three pillars of access, quality, and cost shifting from competing forces to actually reinforcing one another. What do you mean by that? Expand on that thought some for our listeners.
It is the concept of bringing together these elements as opposed to having them compete. I remember going to dozens of conferences a couple of decades ago where people said you can't have a high-quality, affordable system for everyone. Either we can give some people high quality or we can give everyone something lousy, if we want to give everyone something that's good, we won't be able to afford it. I really believe it's the practice of medicine and the evidence base behind that practice that's changed in these years, along with some good thought leadership. We now understand that when people get access to appropriate care, they actually stay healthier, and it costs us less, certainly in the long run and sometimes in the short run. If people obtain care rather than if we deny them care, we've also learned a lot about quality that was in its infancy a couple of decades ago, and understanding the problem of overuse. So there's now a framework in the Affordable Care Act. Obviously, not everyone agrees with the approach it takes, but most of the attention goes to the elements of the Affordable Care Act designed to expand access to care through more health insurance. But there are major elements having to do with cost, particularly modifications to the Medicare program, which is the biggest lever the federal government has, and major initiatives to improve quality. And the hope, of course, is that we can bring those together in a reinforcing way as opposed to a competitive way. I do think our thinking about those three elements has shifted fundamentally, with a very positive sense of what's possible, as opposed to what I remember, which was sort of a resignation that, well, you know, this is the best we can do.
We're speaking today with Editor-in-Chief of Health Affairs, a leading peer review journal. Before that, Mr. Weil was Executive Director of the National Academy for State Health Policy, a nonpartisan organization helping states achieve excellence in health policy and practice. Alan, you focus much of your efforts on improving population health on the state and local levels. Your work at NASHP and the Urban Institute centered on the importance of state policy directives being essential to improve population health. And what do you see in the states? What's exciting about population health?
Yeah, when I think about the Affordable Care Act, it creates a number of tools that states can use. The coverage expansion creates a financing mechanism to give people access to care. The changes in Medicare payment are a catalyst for thinking about accountability in the healthcare system around population health outcomes, as opposed to just paying for each service one at a time. And even states are fairly large units for thinking about population health, but they're a lot closer than the federal government. So between state and local, there are opportunities to think more holistically about the health of the population, and particularly to identify priorities for action. So what I'm struck by as I look around the country is that we can have this high-level policy wonk discussion about accountability, but this only happens if people actually change what they do. Mm-hmm. And that's both clinical practice changes as well as individual and community behaviors, healthier environments. And it's when we start talking about change that we realize you can't change everything at once. And so one of the most powerful efforts that I observe is when a community looks at its own population health statistics and they say, you know, we really need to focus here on children with asthma who are ending up in the hospital when, with appropriate preventive services, they wouldn't have to do that, but also with appropriate attention to their housing, with appropriate attention to their access to social supports that would make them more able to respond. Then you can not just generalize about population health. You can harness the resources of the community to actually do something concrete. And of course, there are downsides to that local as well. Resources often are defined at the national level. But I do think to move past the conceptual, you have to begin to engage locally.
I think it ties to something that you've talked about, this federalism in healthcare. And there's been this fierce debate on states' rights that the Affordable Care Act precipitated. So maybe talk to us a little bit about this new federalism. And also, do you see the possibility of increased regionalism coming into play around healthcare in the future?
Well, we're certainly seeing regional differences in the response to the Affordable Care Act. And many of our largest cities sit on state borders. And So certainly the opportunity to work across state lines to try to solve problems is a practical necessity. And we do see right now, I think it would be naive to deny that the Affordable Care Act embraces an activist role for government in the healthcare sector. It says we have a market failure. We have a lot of people who can't afford coverage, and we're going to solve that by giving resources to those who otherwise wouldn't be able to afford it. And that broad conception of the word, that the state has a primary role in addressing this social problem that not everyone agrees upon, and we have regional differences in the view of that. So some of this is state-federal, but actually much of the tension around the Affordable Care Act is just around public sector versus private sector and the role of government, no matter what level. Now, what I have not seen is a serious effort to define an alternative pathway to achieving the goals of the Affordable Care Act. The law does allow states to apply for waivers in a couple of years, but in order to get one, you still have to cover as many people with as good coverage as the ACA provides. And on the one hand, the state roles in implementing the law are many, and that's been my focus for some time. But a national division over the role of government is a somewhat different discussion than division over whether it should be federal or state. And I actually think a lot of the opposition to the Affordable Care Act is much more about role of government than it is about federal versus state.
Do you want to spend a little time talking about payment reform? You know, Massachusetts started off its initial reform really along the same line, and they've had some good outcomes in terms of their access issues. But talk a little bit about the landscape around payment reform.
Yeah, well, first of all, it's really happening. Again, the Affordable Care Act was a catalyst. It's happening in the private sector as well as in the public sector. The term often used is accountable care organizations because that's what's in the law. And the idea is to pay for the care of a population and to reward those who deliver care to that population so long as they are able to maintain or improve the quality of care that group receives. And they can keep, depending on the payment model, some share of what they save by reallocating their resources without what we used to do, which is just pay for every service delivered regardless of the contribution it made to people's health. So there's no question that this is a real phenomenon, but I do worry that terms like payment reform are a little light on meaning, partly because payment reform is a tool, and the real question is, what's the goal? And then you can ask, given the goal, what kind of payment will support the goal? So we've traditionally paid fee-for-service one piece at a time, and to then reimburse them, pay them for each thing that they do on the expectation and understanding that what they did was valuable. Well, we're now starting to understand, and many physicians would agree, that a lot of what they do is not valuable. And there are many things that are valuable that we don't pay for. We were just talking about social determinants. Interventions that help people live a healthier life tend not to be paid nearly as well as cutting someone open and fixing something inside their body or scanning them and getting an image of what's inside their body. And so payment reform for what? To enable those who deliver care to think differently about the choices that they make. But that then gets to questions of accountability. Are quality metrics, and I've had the fortune to work in the quality arena for a couple of decades now, our quality metrics are still fairly primitive, particularly when it comes to people with complex healthcare needs. And so we say, well, we'll compensate you so long as the quality remains the same or improves, but what does quality mean? Again, returning to my federalism roots, I would say that the working out of the meaning of quality and the purpose of payment reform is something that is much better done locally or at the state level than nationally. that our efforts to change payment at the national level tend to be pretty clunky. Mm-hmm. They're directionally appropriate, but the details are complex. And they need to be worked out by people or sitting around a table with trust who can say, this is how we're going to measure quality. Yes, this is how patients mm-hmm. view quality. This is how clinicians view quality. This is a payment model that will support that. That's, from my perspective, that is by necessity a local discussion, and it's what ties all of these topics together.
We've been speaking to Alan Weil, health policy expert and editor-in-chief of Health Affairs, the leading peer-reviewed journal on health policy. You can learn more about his work by going to healthaffairs.org, and you can follow him on Twitter by going to twitter.com/healthaffairs. Alan, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
It's been a pleasure.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, the Urban Institute is out with a new report that looks at how the Affordable Care Act has affected the number of uninsured. Its survey data showed that the number of uninsured adults dropped by 8 million between September and June. The percentage of uninsured in the United States was an estimated 13.9% in June, compared with 17.9% in September. The drop in the percentage of uninsured was more pronounced in states that expanded Medicaid under the ACA. In those states, the rate of uninsured was 10.1% in June, a 6 percentage point drop from September. Meanwhile, the states that haven't expanded Medicaid, there are currently 24 of them, have an uninsured rate of 18.3%, down slightly from a 20% rate in September. These are, of course, only estimates from a survey taken a few months after the first open enrollment period under the health care law. The data don't include a breakdown of the sources of insurance for the previously uninsured. They do, however, show that the insurance gains overwhelmingly occurred in families whose incomes were below 400% of the federal poverty level. That's $95,400 for a family of four this year, making those families eligible for subsidies on the insurance marketplaces or Medicaid coverage. The survey, which has been taken quarterly since 2013, is funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Urban Institute. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. In the emergency room, or the ICU, clinicians are confronted with a myriad of unpredictable medical crises that sometimes can be challenging to diagnose. Most of these clinicians are now communicating with colleagues via their smartphones, often sending images of a patient's unique symptoms or chest x-rays to one another for shared diagnosis. ICU physician Dr. Josh Landy was noticing a growing trend of image sharing via smartphones to crowdsource second opinions from friends and colleagues across the country. But he also was concerned about the potential violation of HIPAA regulations. So he developed an app for that. He created Figure One, a sort of Instagram for doctors in which images can be de-identified but shared across a dedicated social media platform that would allow input from clinicians within their network. Doctors are using the app to communicate not only with colleagues within their hospital settings, but around the world where someone might have superior expertise with a certain condition. The app was recently used to share a chest image of one of the patients who presented with the Mid-Eastern virus MERS. Dr. Landy says the apps get about 500,000 image views a day, with about 80 million total views so far. He sees the potential for this platform only growing as more young digital natives enter the medical workforce. Figure One is a free download. through Apple App Stores and Google Play, a free downloadable app offering secure HIPAA-compliant image sharing among clinicians around the world to reduce the time it takes to zero in on a diagnosis by tapping the collective expert instantly. Now that is a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.